So welcome to the Kentucky Author Forum, Andrew.
Thank you for having me. I wanted to start
and have you tell us a little bit more about your entrepreneurial entrance into journalism. Why were you so sure that journalism was what you wanted to do, and how did you go about doing it?
Well, I didn't think I really actually wanted to be a journalist when I began this journey, if you will. I started when I was 18 at the New York Times, working for a reporter and columnist named Stuart Elliott, who's still there, who's still the advertising columnist, and I was actually fascinated with advertising. I wanted to be in media, but I actually thought I wanted to be on the other side of the media. I wanted to be on the business side. I wanted to be writing ad copy, and I used to read Stuart religiously, and finally, he gave me an opportunity to come work for him for free for 5 weeks. I literally had no intention of putting two words together, let alone a sentence at all, and it all happened very much by accident. There was an editor there who was new, from a different floor, didn't know who I was or how old I was, and didn't know I wasn't really supposed to even be in the building. And she overheard me talking about this thing called the internet. Now, back then, you know, we used to have to write the word modem, comma, a device that transmits data over a phone line. And I was like a kid who knew what was going on, not because I was a computer whiz or anything, but anyway, so she assigned me the story to write, and I went back to Stuart and I said, "You're not going to believe it, I just got this great assignment." And he said, "But you're in high school, you're not doing this. You need to go back and tell her." And he somehow, I don't know, I persuaded him to let me at least try, and we thought we'd see what happened. And I wrote the story, and they published it, and just, that's how it started. So it was like magic for me, really.
And were you surprised to find yourself in covering business, given that at some big papers, business can be a bit of a backwater? People want to cover politics, they want to cover war, they want to cover foreign affairs. Did you ever wake up and say, how did I find myself a business journalist?
I always liked business. I mean, to me, business was the new politics. That was the human, I love the human drama of business. I have very romantic notions about business, and I think certain people look at politics as a human drama that's, you know, an all-telling story, and to me, business is very much the same way, if not more so, and I think the characters are so outsized and so rich and so deep, and to me, the opportunity to tell those stories every day, and to tell them as a human drama. I mean, people talk about the numbers, and the numbers are important, but ultimately, to me, all of these stories redound back to the people. And the decisions they're making, and why are they making them, and what is their motivation, and what are their incentives. And to the extent that I can tell that story, that's what I really enjoy doing. So
tell us a little bit about Deal Book. You're also unusual for a journalist in that you're very entrepreneurial. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about how Deal Book got started.
Well, Deal Book was an idea that was literally written on the back of a napkin that was really like creating a little small business. And I guess it was my opportunity at the New York Times to try to pretend to be an entrepreneur for a moment. And I had, the New York Times had sent me to London, so after I graduated from college, I'd sort of stuck with them as a freelancer through college, and when I graduated, they sent me to London, and I'd covered mergers and acquisitions over there. And happily, I was okay at it. Maybe better than okay, and they said, come back and do it in New York. And when I got there, very sadly, I would go around and try to meet all of the different people in the deal community, the bankers and the lawyers and consultants and CEOs and board members. And I thought this was actually going to be great because I worked at the New York Times. I was in New York. They'd all say, oh, I read exactly what you write every day. And they didn't. It was clear to me that they were getting the New York Times. But like you said about the backwater, they were leaving the business section at home and taking the Wall Street Journal with them. And I was thinking to myself, how am I going to get in front of these people? Because it's a real vicious circle. I mean, or a virtuous cycle, depending on how it works.
Exactly.
which is you need them to be seeing what you're doing. And so at the same time that was happening, I was also spending an inordinate amount of my own time running around the internet just trying to keep up with what was going on. And I kind of felt like I felt there was an opportunity at that time to actually put everything that I was doing together in one place, to aggregate stuff. I mean, this was sort of pre-blogs, to put all the news in one place. Yeah. And I thought that would be a good service, and if I emailed it to all those people who were leaving the business section at home, maybe I'd be able to get in front of them. Maybe it would be a branding opportunity for the Times. And that's how it started. It started as an email, and I'd gone to the Times and said, I think there's a great opportunity here. I think at the time they thought that maybe we'd reach 30,000 subscribers. Today I think we have 200,000 plus on the email and 2 million on the website. So
it's fantastic.
It's worked out better than I think we all expected.
Talk a little bit more about that virtuous circle. I think Wall Street can be a very hard place to cover in a smart way, and that the public story is often not the private story, and being able to get the private story requires developing sources with often a great deal of work who will whisper in your ear about what's really taking place. And so talk a little bit about that process.
Well, so I started very, very young. Obviously, when I came back to New York, I think I was probably 22 or 23, and I was very scared, in truth, to actually go to lunch with somebody or to have them actually meet me, because I thought they'd look at me and they'd say, you're a child. Why am I going to talk to you and tell you anything? But I think over time, they were seeing the byline, and they were seeing what I was writing, and I think hopefully they thought it was thoughtful. But I was very diligent on moment one about trying to figure out who I needed to know. Mm-hmm. And I would make these lists, and I would call and call and call like a salesperson saying, I want to come meet you for coffee. I want to introduce myself to you. And I knew that it was a long-term game. I think that was actually the hardest part for me because I'm not a patient person. But knowing that if I met you today, I wasn't going to get a great piece of information. I wasn't going to get a great story just by having coffee with you. But then I might get a great story from you 5 years later.
Yep.
And in many respects, that's actually what I think happened with Too Big to Fail. I mean, this was a 10-year investment in lots of relationships, in lots of coffees, in lots of lunches, in lots of calling people, on the weekends, and lots of calling people on their birthdays. And it really actually just trying to establish that relationship and a sense of trust.
Yeah.
Not that you're not going to write tough stuff about them, but that you're going to be fair and that you're fair-minded, and I think that people respect that, and I think people respect people who come to the table with an open mind, but also come with reporting, with research. You have your questions there. You spent the time doing it. I think people respect the fact that if you've actually done the research beforehand, what that actually entails, and I think you get so much more for it on the other end.
Wise advice. Talk about the book. When was there a moment that you said, there's a great book and what's happening now? Was it more of a slow realization, or was there a specific moment in time that you remember as the financial world was melting down around us when you said, this is the stuff of which great books are made?
Well, there's two moments, and one includes you, and I don't know if you'll know this.
No,
The first is that my wife is here tonight, so she actually should get credit for this. I think the moment came at 2:30 a.m. on September 15th, 2008, and to put that in perspective in terms of what was going on at that very moment, Lehman Brothers had filed for bankruptcy about 45 minutes earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Merrill Lynch had just sold itself to Bank of America probably 5 or 6 hours earlier. We were about 32 hours away from AIG getting saved by the government. And I had been working that whole Sunday on the New York Times story that was going to be on the front page the next morning. And I really felt the world was on going to fall off a cliff. I mean, it felt like this was the end. And I remember going home at 2:30 in the morning and being scared out of my mind and actually waking my wife up because I wanted to talk to somebody about it. And she wasn't exactly too thrilled to be woken up. But I told her, you're not going to believe what just happened. And you're not going to believe what just happened and what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And all of the detail, I mean, that weekend was one of those extraordinary weekends because it was such a tale, all of these different characters and people. And I looked at her because, frankly, I wasn't sure I'd ever write a book. And I honestly said, it's like a movie. And she looked at me and said, no, it's like a book. So that's how it all happened. Now, the second piece that involves you that you probably don't know is, so I thought I wanted to do it, but I wasn't totally sure.
I understand
that. And for a whole week, Pilar, my wife, pushed me and pushed me and pushed me to do it. She had much more confidence in me doing this than I ever did. But, and I should congratulate you right now, you have a book coming out in a week that you did with your colleague, Joe Nocera. And your colleague, Joe Nocera, is also a colleague of mine. And we were up at the cafeteria that week, and I said, you know, I think there's a book in this. And he said, you know, you're not going to believe this, but I was just in Chicago with Bethany, and we were saying, I think there's a book in this. So, in fact, in the very beginning, I think we were both worried that we were going to have to compete with each other. I think both books in very many ways actually complement each other tremendously.
I agree with you. So I've always found one of the hardest things about writing a long investigative piece or writing a book is just getting started. Figuring out who do you call first, where do you go first in this morass of material, how do you begin sorting it out? So how did you do that, and did you have any moments during the course of the book of what did I get myself into?
My wife will answer that question, and she will tell you that I think I ask that question every single day. And I won't even get into that. But I think for me the hardest part was actually just starting.
Yep.
The idea of writing so many words, just physically writing these words. I'm not a natural writer. So I think there are certain people, actually like Joe, and maybe you're like this, who I think they play the keyboard like a piano.
I think there are very few of those.
And
I
just
think most people
and
have
just
to work
flows
at it.
Out of them. I sit there and I hunt and I peck and I need to walk around the street.
I sympathize.
And
I'm like
out
you.
What to do? And in fact, when I first got the contract for the book that I was going to have to write, I think they said it had to be 125,000 words or something like that. And I said, no, you don't understand, I can't write that many words. And it's a thick book now. But, you know, it's got to be 100,000 words. I think we actually might have even reduced what was on the contract to actually write.
Yeah.
So, no, I was very scared. But, no, it was an amazing process of putting together who you wanted to talk to. And when I remember when I first started, I made a list and I thought, if I can talk to these 40 people, I'll have a book.
Yep.
Those 40 people turned into 200 plus people, because every time you go and see one person, they say, well, there's this meeting, and by the way, here are the five other people who were at that meeting, and now you have five other people you need to see. So each interview propelled the next one.
So this was a book in which cooperation was obviously essential, right, and in which the people whose cooperation you had to secure are not people who necessarily like to cooperate with things being written about them. And I'm sure that just as you talked about your work for the Times as a virtuous circle, there was something of a virtuous right. circle, or maybe a tipping point in this case, that once you got a certain volume of people, more people were.
Absolutely.
But talk about that.
So there's no question. So when I started, I was scared out of my mind that I wouldn't get all of these people. Mm-hmm. And there were certain people you needed to have to make the story work.
Yeah.
I mean, it was critical.
And who did you think some of those people were?
Well, you know, I've never disclosed who all the sources of the book are. So it's difficult.
Okay.
But there were certain major characters that I thought I needed to be able to get some serious information about to make the book work. No, I think what happened was, I would say about a third of the people, I think, actually talked to me for the right reasons.
Yep.
I think they thought there was a sense of history here. And in fact, one of the CEOs very early on, who I actually didn't know very well, actually showed up at our first interview with his notes from his weekend at the Federal Reserve that Lehman went down. These were the most amazing notes you'd ever seen in your life. He'd actually drawn out in a circle where everybody had sat at the table contemporaneously. I mean, it was just
because
remarkable.
He understood that this was history.
He knew
in the
it.
Making.
I mean, he had quotes. He would write, Paulson, : Dick Fuld is delusional. I mean, it was unbelievable. And so this, you know, this was nirvana. And at the end of the meeting, he handed me the folder and said,
wow.
It's yours. And I said to him the same, I mean, I said, you're really giving me this stuff? And I said, why? And he said, for the same reason I took the notes, which is I knew this was history in the making. So I think that was one of the reasons.
Yeah.
There was a whole other group, probably another third, who probably spoke to me for all the wrong reasons. This was a group that wanted to rewrite history, wanted to spin, wanted to resurrect their legacies or shift blame or what have you. And I think some of those people came to the table for those reasons. And, of course, my job was to try to keep them honest.
Yeah.
And then the last third was the third that probably didn't want to talk to me at all, for obvious reasons. There were so many investigations going on. There were criminal investigations, civil litigation. And ultimately, I think what happens, as you said, with that virtuous circle or vicious cycle or whatever it is, you get to the point where you know, where they know that you know too much or enough to be dangerous. And the call that I always remember was an executive I was trying to get on the phone forever, would never talk to me. His lawyers, his friends told me, leave him alone. I finally got him, right actually towards the end of the book, got him on the phone, and I said, I know you don't want to talk to me, but at least let me tell you what I have, and then you can make a decision about what you want to do. And he says, okay, Andrew, tell me, but I promise you it's not going to change my mind. Of course, I said to him, okay, let me get my notes, and I got my notes, and I said, okay, well, I have you in a scene. It's July 13th. It's a Saturday morning, 10:30 in the morning. You're at John Mack's house in the living room. You're on the couch on the right. It's a green couch. And you're eating a chicken wrap sandwich. His wife, Christy, had just brought you the sandwich. Your son's lacrosse game started at 12:30, but you didn't show up till 1:30, and this is what you said. Of course, there's this long pause on the telephone, to which, of course, he says, I think we should talk. So that's sort of, I think, how the process evolved, and ultimately I was the beneficiary of almost a mini competition between some of the sources to prove that they were right, meaning they would come with information, or I would ask them something, get a piece of information, and then it wouldn't match up. And then they would say, and I'd go back to them and say, this doesn't make sense. You know, there's five people in the room, you say this. And they would say, well, let me get you all the emails then. Or let me get you the phone records, or let me get you the whatever. And so it was a lot of teasing out all of those things. And part of it was teasing out the big picture of the story, but also just even the little details. I used to show up at interviews with menus from restaurants that I knew the meeting that took place, so I could say, well, what did you eat? And normally they'd say, oh, I don't remember what I ate, but if you actually hand them a menu and then they look, they go, oh, that we had this and this wine and blah, blah, blah. So
that's a great tactic. Talk a little bit about that process of keeping people honest, and there are two, which you mentioned, and there are two ways in which it's necessary. One are on the details. Were you here at this time? What time did this person call you? Did this happen? But the trickier part is when somebody's recollection or somebody's sense of how things played out does not jive with other people's. And as a journalist, you can listen for a long time, but at some point you have to make a call.
Right.
And talk a little bit about those tough moments of making a call.
I was a beneficiary of a couple of things, and one was actually that certain people that I found and discovered, unfortunately actually probably closer to the middle of the process than at the beginning, I wish I'd found them earlier, took notes and had emails. And I think that those things, actually more than anything else, was what let me keep people honest, meaning
Contemporaneous
documents change everything.
Yep.
And invariably, before every phone, before every conference call, and this was a book filled with conference calls, there was an email that said, at 2 o'clock, we're going to have a conference call about XYZ. And invariably at 2:30, there was another email that said, we just finished the call, and now we have to do X, you know, A, B, and C. And so when people would say, oh, this is what happened in the meeting, and then it didn't jive with the email, you could clearly go back to it. Now, a lot of people, even those people who were trying, I mean, there were the spinners, but there were people who I think I spoke to in complete good faith who, given actually how sleepless this period was for many people, just didn't know. They would transpose days. I had a CEO who was convinced he was at a meeting that he clearly was never at. And some of that's a judgment call, but it's also once you talk to the 8 other people in the room, they say, no, he wasn't there, I promise you.
Yep.
And he says, I really was there. You know, you have to make those calls. I think in the fact-checking process, I was able to actually get in front of a lot of those issues by actually going back to people and saying, look, here's where we are. I know you have this view of what happened, but I have 7 other people. And it was almost a little bit of a journalistic shuttle diplomacy to the point where, really, for the most part, they agreed. I had very rare instances where people really fundamentally disagreed that something happened in a completely different way.
Interesting. What were your preconceptions about the crisis, if any, heading into the book? And did the process of writing the book change any of those for you? Were there people you might have viewed as pure evil, clear villains, before you started writing the book that you perhaps came to have a more nuanced view of?
Yes, across the board. And I had a very black and white view going into this. And I think actually most people, even today, unfortunately, I actually have a very black and white view. There are clear white hats and clear black hats. And I think that the whole goal of this project in many ways was to try to bring the reader and the public inside the room so you could actually see what was going on. Because I think ultimately, your field of vision changes when you're in the room. And nothing is black and white anymore, and everything is gray. And the guy that you think is great can be awful, and the guy you think is awful can be great. I don't think I understood how bad things were. I think that was actually probably one of the greatest surprises. Even writing these stories every single day during that week when it felt like the world really was going to fall apart, it was worse.
Yeah.
I mean, much, much worse. And there's some anecdotes which we can talk about just, you know, threw me for a loop. I also think the sense of what the government was doing behind the scenes.
Yeah.
People talk about the invisible hand. It was invisible to us, but there was a very visible hand going on during this period that was really all the deal-making and matchmaking and things that were taking place. My favorite line is the CEOs at one point started calling Tim Geithner E-Harmony. That's my all-time favorite, which I will never forget the person who mentioned that to me first. But Yeah.
So talk, speaking of those characters and those stories, talk a little bit about one of the very visible hands of the government, which was Hank Paulson. And one of the great scenes in your book is at the beginning of the book, as the crisis is beginning, and Paulson, who used to be the CEO of Goldman Sachs, is at this board meeting in Russia. And it sets up the conflicts that Paulson faces in his dual life as the former CEO of Goldman Sachs and the current Treasury Secretary really, really beautifully. But I also couldn't help thinking as I read your book that you liked Paulson. So tell us about that scene and tell us about how it shaped your perceptions of Paulson and how you came to view him.
Okay, so Paulson, I thought, was going to be the most difficult character to write about because in a very black and white way, going into the book, I actually thought he was a pretty cardboard character. I thought he was going to be very two-dimensional. I didn't know how deep you'd be able to really get with him. I thought it was actually going to be very tough for the audience or the reader to be invested, whether they liked him or not, to be just invested in what was going on with him. And I also thought there was this remarkable conflict, which was hanging over his entire time in office. Now, the scene that you talk about was actually a scene, for the whole time I was writing this book, I was trying to figure out the conspiracy. Everybody would say that something very bad was about to happen at all times. If you talk to all the characters, there was a true sense that Goldman was about to do something very bad and the government was going to help them, and it was always, and there was something horrible happening. But nobody ever had the proof.
Yep.
And finally, I give my researcher credit for this, actually. I was doing the scene around Goldman Sachs' board meeting, just around what they were doing. It was actually supposed to be just a Goldman-only sequence. And my researcher said to me, because she had made these elaborate calendars, she said, you know, it's very interesting, on Hank Paulson's public calendar, he was in Moscow at the same time as the Goldman meeting. And I said, well, that must just be a coincidence, because there's no way that they would have ever talked to each other there. I mean, just, you would never put each other, I just couldn't even conceive of it or believe it. And in truth, the horrible reporter that I am, I didn't, for about a week and a half, or 2 weeks, didn't even make a call on it, because I just thought, so crazy.
Well, I completely understand that. It's so easy to get blinded by your perceptions
just
of what
to be,
could be.
No way. Yeah. So I'm on the phone with a board member, actually, and at the end of the call, I say, by the way, you didn't see Hank Paulson when you were in Moscow, did you? And he says, how do you know about that? And that's actually how the whole thing sort of began for me. So.
And talk a little bit more about how you came to see Paulson as not a two-dimensional character. He's such an important figure in this, in your book, and in how people think about the crisis overall.
Well, before we go there, I should just say one thing about the Russia scene, because I thought the Russia scene represented this conflict, and I was hoping, as a storyteller, that there was going to be a horrible story, I mean, a great story, but a horrible situation for them to be told, meaning... And ultimately, by the way, what happens, of course, is that they do meet in Russia. They meet secretly in this hotel room at the Marriott, the entire board in his hotel suite. It's left off all of the official calendars. And you'd think, I thought maybe that, you know, I was hoping
this
I'd
is
find...
It. This is the proof.
I was hoping I was going to find out that they were in this room, you know, plotting on how they were going to take over the world. And he was going to tell them, you know, that Lehman Brothers was going out of business in 2 months and you should short the heck out of them and all of that kind of... I mean, I really... That's what you were hoping for. And ultimately... You know, every avenue I went down, that's not, you know, it's not, it was actually much more innocent, even though it looked horrible. And I think there were a lot of instances like that. Now, larger picture on Paulson. Paulson to me is a very mixed character. I think, and we haven't talked about Lehman Brothers yet, but to me the great mistake of this crisis was in not saving Lehman Brothers or not getting in front of Lehman Brothers before that weekend. So I actually fault Paulson and Bernanke and Geithner and everybody who was in power at that period for that failure. Having said that, and it's very hard to disconnect from that mistake because that, I think, was a true tipping point and domino for a lot of other things. Many of the steps they took and the work they did during that next week and the weeks after, I actually think have been remarkable. And I think, oddly enough, history will look more fondly upon those individuals for the decisions they made during that period than we probably do now.
Before we get to Lehman, let's pause a little bit on Goldman Sachs, because in the wake of the crisis, and it was kind of an amazing turn in some ways, Goldman became very much the public villain of the crisis, with Rolling Stone dubbing them a, what, great vampire squid great right wrapped around squid. The yep. face of humanity or something like that. And it's really interesting, because there were always these whispers on Wall Street among Goldman's competitors and peers where they always feared that Goldman was up to no good. So it's not just the populace at large that had this sense of Goldman Sachs. It's Goldman's peers that thought the same thing. Is there any there?
I think there's there to the extent that there is true paranoia on Wall Street that Goldman is about to do something bad at all times and is going to somehow screw their clients in some way that they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think if you talk to the clients, they say, we know we might get screwed, but we like to do business with them anyway. That's really what you hear, I think, over and over and over again. You know, I think since the book came out, since the crisis happened, and actually you've done some really good reporting on this, the Abacus situation that came out, where we really learned that actually Goldman was playing both sides of these things in ways that I don't think we fully understood. Now, was Goldman any worse than any of these other banks? I'm not sure. And that's the question that I still sort of am unclear about. But I definitely think that what Goldman did really represents, frankly, what was going on across Wall Street, and what they were doing is something I don't think any of us appreciated at the time.
So let's talk a little bit about Lehman. Both Lehman and its former CEO, Dick Fuld, really play starring roles in your book, and there's that just amazing scene, so compelling, at the beginning of the book, of Fuld's car leaving his house in the early morning hours, and it's ominous and touching all at once. And you made an interesting remark to me once, which I'm paraphrasing, that some people come away from your book thinking Fuld is the epitome of evil, and other people come away from your book almost seeing him as something of a tragic hero. So how do you think about him? And do you view him as the person who's to blame for Lehman's demise, or do you spread the blame more broadly to other members of Lehman's management team and even to events beyond Fuld's control?
A lot of questions.
Sorry.
A lot of good questions. I have very mixed feelings is probably the best answer. I love Dick Fuld as a character.
Mm-hmm.
He is the most rich, complicated character in the book. And what I love about him is actually that the readers have reacted exactly the way I was hoping, which is that some people would love him and some people would hate him. In fact, before I started writing this book, I actually saw a great interview which sort of helped me think about the whole book, which was Charlie Rose did this interview with Quentin Tarantino. And at the end of the interview, he asked him what his goal was when he made a picture. And now I will probably screw up the paraphrasing of his answer, but it was remarkable. Which was, he said that his goal was when the movie was over, and the lights went up in the theater, he hoped that every single person in the auditorium thought they were watching a different movie. And I always thought that was a great way to think about the book and a great way to think about Dick Fuld.
Yeah.
Because there are aspects of him which are very human,
mm-hmm.
and really, I think, demonstrate the fragility of just, you know, the human mind and what happens during these things. And then there are mistake after mistake after mistake, and maybe you can call it worse than mistake. I mean, there are people who would truly say he is the villain of the picture. He's somebody that I think was so... He loved the firm.
Mm-hmm.
He was blinded in many respects by his love for the firm. He was surrounded by all of the wrong people, legitimately all the wrong people. He was a leader in that there were people who would literally lie down in traffic for this man. But that it almost that loyalty in a way almost became the problem.
That's
and I think at the very end, when he needed to make some really hard decisions, he couldn't. He couldn't let it go. He couldn't. And it's not to me about, you know, people talk about Wall Street and greed. For him, I don't think this had anything to do with greed at all. I don't think it had anything to do with money at all. This was someone who had $1 billion of stock, who rode his $1 billion of stock down to $56,000. So I think this was about pride for him. And I think about that all the time, because people talk about incentive structures and what can we do to motivate people to do the right things.
Yeah.
I don't know how you regulate pride.
Yeah.
And I think, so in some cases I do think that he can be considered a tragic figure at some level.
I think that's a fascinating observation, and I think in general, in stories of business gone wrong, Wall Street gone wrong, business gone wrong, pride is at least as powerful a factor as greed, and they're often mixed together
and
in very
interesting
ways.
That's not to say there's not greed. Listen, there were a lot of other characters where I would put greed at the top of the list, but with Dick Fuld in particular, I think it's actually it's a much more complicated, nuanced scene.
Speaking of tough decisions to be made, mm-hmm. you begin your book at a time when the financial crisis was already underway, and you tell the story wonderfully of the great collapse, right. as I sometimes think about it. Do you think the wheels were already set in motion at the start of your narrative, or do you think there's something someone could have done along the way to make events come out differently than they did?
You're absolutely right. The book is about the crisis and how it developed to the peak, to sort of the apex of it, but it wasn't about how we got here. In fact, I think that's what your book probably does better than anybody else's book.
Fingers crossed.
But this was a book about could they have mitigated the situation? Could have we avoided the crisis completely? I'm not so sure. Hank Paulson came into office in 2006. Mm-hmm. I think the train had already left the station. I think the train had already left the station for a lot of this. A lot of the policies that were put in place, a lot of the programs and things that were going on Wall Street, I think, had already left the station too. So were there things they could have done to mitigate it, and did they exacerbate it? And I think, by the way, on both counts, I think there are moments where they clearly exacerbated it, and there's clearly moments where maybe they mitigated it, and there's moments where they probably could have mitigated it a lot better than they did.
And there are probably moments when we still don't know the answer and may never, because we'll never get to check out the alternative.
Right. And so this is really a story as much about how we got into it. This is about the arsonists, and sometimes the arsonists, are the same people who are in the rescue squad, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the interesting component about it. And by the way, many of those same people are still on the police force. Today, Ben Bernanke, Tim Geithner. So it's, but I think about that a lot because the crisis, in earnest began probably in June or rather July or August of 2007. But I think much of actually what your book really represents is all of the things that happened over the prior decade, which really actually brought us to this point. And that's fascinating unto itself.
So talk to me a little bit about Tim Geithner. One of the scenes you have of him in the book is him running along the East River, I think, mm-hmm. and he's actually thinking about other people and how they're going to come out okay in this. And it sets up,
I didn't believe that scene initially, by the way. I want you to know. Because it's actually it's a little bit of a puffery, it feels like a puffy kind of scene for
Tim Geithner. I was going to say, it sets you up to feel sympathetic toward Geithner or to view him favorably.
I think in that moment, you probably do. And I think, to his credit, I actually think those were real thoughts. And in complete fairness, I actually only learned about that because somebody else had mentioned how he had come back from this run and they all thought he was acting like a crazy person because all of a sudden he was talking about people on boats and trying to save the world and all this happy talk. So I believe it to be the case, but I don't think the book is trying to suggest necessarily that he's a hero of any sort. I think actually that he to me has one of the more really mixed records in that he's throwing spaghetti against the wall. He's sort of the monkey in the middle between Ben Bernanke, the sort of old wise man, and Hank Paulson, the sort of shoot first, ask questions later kind of guy. And I think Tim is sort of in the middle and also sort of trying to find his own sea legs. Because he's turned himself, I think, over the past year and a half, since he's been the Treasury Secretary, into a leader. But I don't think that he was like that. And I think we all learned, actually, when he first became the Treasury Secretary, that he wasn't like that. So I was not. That scene was probably trying to show that he was thoughtful about those issues, but it wasn't necessarily to suggest that you should fall in love with him tomorrow.
Thank heavens. You talk a little bit about about these interesting scenes involving Lehman with David Einhorn, the short seller, and for non-financial type, short sellers are people who are betting that stocks are going to go down in value. And David Einhorn began pointing out in the spring of 2008 that there were these deep problems with Lehman, that its assets were overvalued and trouble was coming. And I have a particular interest in this topic because I often see short sellers as the canary in the coal mine. Right. But at the behest of Wall Street CEOs, at the height of the crisis, the SEC actually banned short selling. And I have to admit, I have a view on this. I see this as hypocrisy, mm-hmm. in that Wall Street CEOs always cite the market as the reason why they should get paid their millions. But as soon as the market turns against them, they say, yeah, the market's being manipulated. Fix this. Stop it for us. But yet, many Wall Street CEOs still blame short sellers, right, for the crisis. Where do you think the truth lies?
For me, I actually don't think that short sellers caused this or created this. I do think towards the end, there were some that were exacerbating the problem or the situation. But that was really at the very bitter end, because when you think about what a bank run is, when there's a true run on the bank, it's a true undermining of confidence across the board. And when you have people preying on other people at that point, David Einhorn should be given an enormous amount of credit for spotting these problems. But I'll tell you, as a reporter, and I'm sure you felt this on the other end, I remember when David came out and was telling the world this, not everybody believed him so quickly, because the immediate reaction was, oh, but he's a short seller. Yeah. He has an incentive to tell everybody this. Of course, why should we listen to him? And yet we never talk about, no one ever says, when somebody says, Microsoft stock should go up, nobody says, well, they're long. It's an interesting dynamic, and I think actually Lehman Brothers, for a couple months, was actually able to sort of leverage that notion to actually keep people in the public and investors and probably the press at some level from actually going as far as ultimately we did in terms of understanding what was really happening there.
And were you shocked by the fact that the Wall Street CEOs actually succeeded in getting short selling banned? I remember seeing a little note in the paper that it was right around the same time that China was opening its market to short selling.
Right.
I thought that was an interesting parallel.
I think they were truly scared out of their minds, and I think they really felt that, and they were hearing rumors all day long, mm-hmm. that somehow the short sellers were doing this to them. And in truth, what was happening was there were short sellers and hedge funds that were shorting the stock. Now, were they shorting the stock because they thought the company was going to go out of business? Partially. But partially, they were actually they were trying to make what they thought was a good bet. And there became this, in this case, a vicious cycle, which was that if you had your money at Lehman Brothers and you couldn't get all of your money out, you might buy insurance, so CDS, effectively protection, against this happening. And by the way, then you might short the company because that's the only way you could hedge the money you were worried you wouldn't be able to get out of the company. So I think that cycle happened over and over and again, and I think there were other people who saw that cycle happening who didn't necessarily have any skin in the game but decided, by the way, that's a good bet to bet, yeah, this is not going to work. And then and I think all that compounded. Yeah. And it became so emotional. Yeah. I mean, it was true. These people, this was their livelihoods. And again, as much as the greed enters the picture, which it does, at the very bitter end for all of these people, it really was about pride. And this, Wall Street, as you know so well, it's an ego-driven business. So I think for so many of them, when it really came to that almost bitter end, it really was the end for them.
Talk to me about these two little words, risk management. You hear that a lot on Wall Street. What is it supposed to mean, and what did it actually mean?
It's supposed to mean that you're supposed to understand what you truly have at risk, how much money you can lose on any given day. We could talk about VAR. I don't know if we want to get into some of these issues. But it's about hedging your risk. It's about knowing. And ultimately, these people didn't. And I think, to me, one of the great lessons, actually, of spending all this time with so many of these people in pursuit of this book was that so many of them fundamentally didn't even understand their own businesses. Mm-hmm. And you talk about institutions that are too big to fail, but to me, ultimately, in some cases, this was a story about firms that were too big to manage. J.P. Morgan is a massive institution. Citigroup is a massive institution. There are very few CEOs that can explain to you what's going on with the various tranches of a CDO, then tell you about their investment banking business, and then tell you why the ATM machine on 21st Street is broken, right? I mean, that's what you're after. And the question is, should we expect, by the way? I mean, that's another issue, and I've been trying to sort of sort through this issue myself. Should we expect the boards and the CEOs to actually be able to understand every component of their business? It's a real question.
It's a real question.
I mean, we'd all like them to, but not so easy.
J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon has really emerged as a hero of the crisis in a lot of people's minds. For whatever reason, nothing seems to have stuck
because
to him.
Because he can actually talk to you about the various tranches of the CDO and then why the ATM machine is broken. He's actually one of the
few... So in your view, he deserves that.
He's, if you ever listen to a conference call that Jamie Dimon gives, it is unlike any other call that I think most of the CEOs in Wall Street give, truly. He actually does understand everything, or at least comes off as understanding everything, and he can talk to you about the numbers. He has them on the top of his head. It's part of him in a way that I think so many of these other people don't have that. There's some who are great leaders. They're great Pied Pipers. They're people who lie down in traffic for them. But if you asked them what was going on three floors below them, they wouldn't know.
Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about Ben Bernanke. He, in many ways, seems like a... maybe not a passive character, but somebody whose quiet was drowned out by Hank Paulson.
If we could do this, before we go there, I apologize, on Jamie, because it's one thing that I think that people don't appreciate.
Yeah.
The reason why Jamie was able to get through this crisis, I think, unlike so many of the others, was he truly did have better information than everybody else. He had a better vantage point. You could even call it insider information, which was he was the clearing bank for Lehman Brothers. He saw the trades every day. He was the clearing bank for Merrill Lynch. He saw the trades. He was sucking the collateral back because he knew they were in trouble. He was the advisor to AIG.
Right.
I mean, so when you really think about that, he had a vantage point that, frankly, I don't think Hank Paulson, Ben Bernanke, or Tim Geithner had. He really could see it, and he could see it early, and I think he was able to take steps to avoid some of the worst decisions around the crisis. He also, by the way, made a prescient decision early on around mortgages and not going down that road as far as some of the other banks did. Yeah. Back to Ben Bernanke, I apologize.
No, that was a great segue. Talk about Ben Bernanke and his role during the crisis and as a way also to bridge the distance between the crisis and the events in your book and where we are today.
I think his role, first of all, he's changed, in my mind, remarkably throughout the past 2.5 years. And his role within government has changed. You know, in the pecking order of the book or the period during the crisis, Hank was sort of running the show. Ben Bernanke truly was sort of the old wise man who was trying to advise and working on monetary policy and things like that. And Tim Geithner, as I said earlier, was sort of the monkey in the middle. Ben Bernanke didn't want to get involved in all this deal making. He didn't understand these Wall Street people. This was not for him. He truly is an academic. Today, I think his role, though, has changed, which is between Geithner and him, they're much more equals. I didn't see that at the time. I would actually put Paulson over here. I mean, I thought he was truly leading the charge, and Ben was sort of not playing second fiddle, but
a little more passive.
Much more passive. Today, I think it's actually a reversal, in part because I think of really just the way, frankly, Tim Geithner approaches his job and his personality and his disposition.
Interesting. You end the book with the moment when the 9 big banks take their TARP funds, and you have a Treasury staffer describing this as the moment of crossing the Rubicon.
Right.
But yet, here we are a few years later, and most of the big banks have paid back the money in a much shorter time frame than anybody thought possible. Do you still see that as crossing the Rubicon?
I do, and I'll tell you why I ended the book there. I ended the book there for two reasons. One was actually pure drama. It was the only scene in the book where it could get all the main characters in the same room together. So you're actually following lots of different sequences of different storylines.
Yeah.
And did you ever watch the movie Crash?
I did, and all the threads come together.
And all the threads come together. So I was desperate for that, and it worked out perfectly that actually happened in real life. So I liked it for the drama perspective, but I also thought, in truth, it was the tipping point. It was the moment at which the government took a much more aggressive role, not a passive role, and really almost nationalizing the banks. Now, I know the money's come back. I think, by the way, if you were to ask Hank Paulson today, he would tell you that he actually wished the money hadn't come back so quickly. You know, the original plan was for these banks to hold this money for 3 to 5 years. I've talked to Treasury officials, or former Treasury officials, from that period,
who were remarkably frustrated by the fact that the money's come back, because their view was, keep it out there, they need it. Yep. Because for every dollar that's coming back to the government, it's not a dollar that's going out to the economy. So the plan did not, in truth, the plan did not work the way they expected. Yep. Now, I would argue the plan actually did work, though. I think it was misadvertised and mislabeled in that it was oversold as something that was going to truly spur the economy.
Yep.
I think it should have been sold as, we're going to keep the patient from dying.
Yep.
So the patient doesn't flatline. Yep. And I think that's happened. And I think now we're sort of starting the process of rehab, if you will. But I don't think that, you know, when you go back and look at TARP, we might get most of our money back. I actually think, as unpopular a program as it was and is, and I'm not sure it will ever be popular, I do think historians may look back and say, this was actually the right thing to do. Was it the right way to go about it? We can talk about how it was executed, the strings that were attached or weren't attached.
Right. What do you make of the remarkable divergence between Wall Street and Main Street in the years since the crisis? We've had, as we just discussed, this amazing rebound on Wall Street, and yet we've had no rebound whatsoever on Main Street. Why has that happened, and is that what you would have anticipated?
So sadly, I did anticipate this, but for a different reason. I think there's a view that we gave them all this money, they should turn around and lend the money out.
Mm-hmm.
It was very clear to me on day one that they were going to hoard the money, because they needed to hoard the money, because they were actually much worse off shape than I think we even knew then. The next piece of it is the fact, actually, that I think, unfortunately, we're still in a very lousy economy. And the old saw on Wall Street is, a banker only hands you an umbrella on a sunny day. True. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. And I think today there are many bankers that think it's either raining or still about to rain. And I think that, and I also think that we have to figure out what, to borrow the phrase of Muhammad Alarian, what the new normal is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we were so preconditioned to thinking the bank should be lending to all of us, but so now we're very frustrated that those loans are not being made the way they should be. And in truth, there are people who should be getting loans that aren't. But at the same time, I think there's probably, I don't think we've come to grips yet with what that new normal is, and the fact that the world we lived in 2007 was an artificial world. And I think that's a real issue, by the way, also around employment.
Yeah.
You know, what is the new normal around employment? You know, are we trying to get back to 2007 levels, or are we trying to get back to 2004 levels? And what does that feel like?
Not a pleasant process.
Sorry to depress the audience.
Are there lessons that you think both Wall Street and Washington should have taken away from your book?
Yes. And I would tell you that the saddest part about the book, for me, more than anything else, was the one word the CEOs used repeatedly about themselves, which is they called themselves survivors, those that made it to the other side. Almost as if they were cancer survivors. And it, to me, represented a lack of appreciation for what had just happened, for their role in being the arsonists in many cases. And while they can be given some credit for parts of the rescue in some regard, I think they're missing the first piece of it. And also missing the component that we all, the taxpayers, rescued them. They really weren't survivors at all. And what that then means about their own responsibilities to the community and to the country and to the world, it's the global economy. And so I think I was most surprised when it came time for regulation and for legislation that the folks who were pushing back the hardest were the banks. Now, I knew they'd push back on certain things, but I was surprised at how hard they pushed back. That, to me, was actually the great surprise. Even today, I'm surprised even now that the legislation is enacted, is there, and some of these reforms have to get worked out and executed, that they're back pressing and pressing and pressing to repeal, to push back. That to me is the surprising part, because ultimately that I think they must recognize the loss of trust that's happened during this period, and I think it's only getting eroded more by some of the actions that are being taken place today.
And by some of the headlines surrounding the fact that not only could they not make mortgages correctly, but they can't foreclose correctly now, or legally either, right?
They get you coming and going.
So.
has the process of the writing the book changed the way you approach your work for Dealbook? Has it had any kind of impact on how you think now as a reporter?
Yes, in that I always, as I said, when I always loved the great narrative, the great human drama. Mm-hmm. Now I know what's possible. You know, as a reporter on a newspaper, you have a day or two to figure it all out. And when you actually spend a year trying to figure it all out, you realize how rich and how deep you could get if you just had the time. And so I think now I spend a lot of, maybe I'm wistful of these moments where I think, you know, if we just had another week to figure this out, we could really get a really rich tale. I think I do approach it a little bit more like that. I think I probably am focused a little bit more on the Quentin Tarantino aspect, which is, can you really write a story down the middle, but it really does create these different impressions. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, it's about nuance, which Jonas Ehre, your co-author and my friend, does so well.
Yes, he's a master at drawing out nuance. I forgot to ask you the burning question on everybody's mind, I'm sure, which is Dodd-Frank, the new legislation.
Is that really the burning question?
I was thinking that it must be the question you get asked in every single interview, and I wasn't going to ask it, and then I thought I would feel guilty about not asking it.
I probably don't have a great answer.
What do you think is the best or the most hopeful thing about it, and what do you think is perhaps the most dangerous thing about it?
The most hopeful thing about it is probably the Consumer Protection Bureau, in that when you think about how we got here, and you can speak to this better than I can, and I'd love to turn the tables if I'm allowed.
But I plan to keep asking you questions in rapid fire. That
particular component of the bill could protect consumers and avoid all of these human drama, the human turmoil, the stories that you hear, these anecdotes in the paper that actually make great stories but make for really awful lives. Yeah. I think that can actually be avoided. The most important tool in the legislation, I think, though we don't know how it's going to work in practice, is this idea of resolution authority, this idea that we can end too-big-to-fail banks, but only at the bitter end. Yeah. And for those who aren't totally exposed to what resolution authority is, it's this idea that we can actually wind down a big investment bank like a Lehman Brothers or an insurance company like an AIG or a hedge fund without having to send it into bankruptcy, which ultimately I think is what really triggered the sort of tsunami around Lehman Brothers. In much the same way that we can do with a commercial bank, the FDIC can actually unwind a commercial bank without really wreaking remarkable havoc. The question is how that tool will be used and whether it will ultimately be too late. We're not breaking up the banks. The too big to fail banks are now too big to fail, probably squared.
A huge irony, isn't it?
Completely. But I do have some faith or hope that this is providing some level of a backstop, because it's actually really the only new tool that the legislation gives the government at all.
Talk a little bit about what challenges you think people who cover business, those of us who write about businesses, what are the big challenges we face, and have they changed at all, both with the changes in journalism and now the heavier Washington involvement in the business world?
Great question. You know, to me, it's changed in a couple of ways. The sad part is, I think, has actually become, because there's so many people competing in the financial space, it's become institutionalized in a very bad way. Yep. You know, before I started writing my book, I read your book, The Smartest Guys in the Room, and I went back and read Barbarians at the Gate and some of what I thought were the great narratives of our time, and I read these rich tales and thought, they couldn't have had a PR person involved at this point because some of the stuff that you were getting was so rich and so colorful. I think what's made it hard today is that there's so many walls. You know, despite all of the documentation that and press releases and filings you have to make with the SEC, you still can't really get under it. At some of the biggest banks, it's still a black box. It's a black box not just for the journalists, it's a black box for the analysts and investors. And people, by the way, are investing in many of these institutions completely blindly and happily so, for better or worse. I also think the hard part is getting inside the room. Mm-hmm. I still think that story is so important because I think when you can get inside the room and see it, but see the truth, it really does change your perspective. But getting inside that room is tougher than ever. And the number of lawyers, I would call, you know, immediately, probably half the people I would call to even just get an interview or a meeting when I was working on the book, the first call would go to the person, which would get routed directly to the lawyer.
I had an astonishing experience on my book. I was emailing with someone, I thought, and then I ended up at a conference sitting next to a lawyer, and we started talking, and he quickly figured out who I was and said, "Oh, you thought you were emailing with so-and-so. Right. Actually, you were emailing with me."
I think that's the hardest part. And what's so interesting to me about now having an opportunity to cover a little bit of this nexus of Wall Street and Washington. In Washington, the people who are elected have to deal with you at some level as a journalist. They are public servants, and part of their role is to communicate what they're doing, for better or worse. On Wall Street, there's in some cases zero incentive actually to talk to a journalist. I can make my arguments, and I have hopefully good ones, but truly I think that's actually the hardest part. And knowing that there's this other community in Washington that has an agenda, can push it, and you can really see it even just in the cable broadcasts every day. You can say what you want about, business cable TV, but it's very different in that you really don't have that same kind of agenda pushing, everybody moving different ways all day long. It's a different situation.
Well, it'll be an interesting new world, that's for sure. And thank you so much, Andrew.
Oh, thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Now we have time for some great questions from you, our audience.
Yes, I've been amazed that there hasn't been any mention about regulation and the lack of regulation and the fact that we've ended up with these derivatives and subprimes and all the things that more mortgages have been packaged up and sold in a bundle and nobody cares if they're paid anymore or not. And I'd like to hear you talk about this a little bit.
Well, I've been talking, and she actually has a book coming out literally next week that actually hits at all of these issues better than my book ever does. So, floor is yours.
That just wasn't fair. I think that lack of regulation played an enormous role in the crisis. I think there were... There was an argument constantly by the financial community starting in the early 1990s when subprime lending began to take off, which was, if you regulate this more tightly, then credit will dry up. And we don't want credit to dry up now, do we? And what I came to find really fascinating about that is that actually a lot of community activists were out there at the same time saying, please dry up credit. People are getting bad loans. People are getting loans they can never afford to pay back. Not only is this bad for consumers, this is bad for the banking system, because in the end, a banking system is built on sound loans. And the lending industry would say to the politicians, oh, but if you do this, credit will dry up. And I really came to see this notion that credit is good for us as something that was sold by the financial industry, and Washington became too enamored of that message and too scared to do anything that would risk it. And then you venture into these complex products. There's actually just a fascinating tale through the 1990s about the failure to regulate derivatives, despite many people in Washington speaking up and saying, look, we don't even need to regulate. We just need more information so that if something does go wrong, we've got a chance of fixing it before it becomes a big problem. And the industry would push back using almost the same language that, well, this is innovation, this is creation, this is the American economy at work. If you regulate this, innovation is going to dry up. And I've come to be actually very suspicious of those two things, both innovative, what innovative actually means in financial services, and whether and whether credit is really something that consumers want or something that the financial industry wants to sell them.
Questions right over here, please.
Part of the reason for the unpopularity of TARP and the bailouts were the unbelievable salaries and bonuses enjoyed by the people who were in many ways responsible for the financial crisis we were in. Did you form any opinions about the appropriateness of the salaries and bonuses, and whether there should have been more done by government to restrict those salaries and bonuses with taxpayer money.
Can I take that for a sec? I think about that issue all of the time, and to me, the great mistake, and for those of you who've read the book, and if you haven't read the book, I'll be ruining this moment for you, but it doesn't matter. Towards the end of the book, when you actually get to this scene where Paulson and Bernanke and Geithner call the nine largest banks and say, come to Washington, and they're basically thinking they're going to have to force the banks to take something, I think, on the order of $165 billion that day. So each bank is going to get something between $10 and $25 billion of those nine banks. And the goal at the time was that there were some of those nine banks, like Citigroup, that really needed the money. Other banks in that group, like J.P. Morgan and potentially Goldman Sachs, though it's a debatable issue, might not have needed that money, at least at that time. And the reason they wanted to give out the money to all nine banks was this idea that somehow you would put a scarlet letter on the banks that actually needed it, that you were trying to destigmatize the TARP program. Also, because the hope was that other banks, smaller community banks around the country, would then come and participate in the program as well. And the worry that they had, and I don't know, and this is a real issue, and I'd actually be curious what you think about this, was they felt at the time that if they put real strings on compensation, for example, that banks like J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs wouldn't take it because they'd say, we don't need the money. Why are we going to do this? Now, in truth, the banks took the money much quicker than Hank Paulson, Ben Bernanke, or Tim Geithner ever expected. That afternoon, the expectation was they were going to try to have to sell them on taking the money, and they were going to spend the evening, you know, for hours and hours and hours trying to sell them on this idea, and it was going to take forever. Within an hour, the banks had taken the money happily, or maybe an hour and a half. So I would have liked to see more strings attached. I think we all would have liked to see more strings attached. The real question in my mind is whether you needed to destigmatize the program like this. I think actually a lot of investors saw right through this. We all knew that Citigroup was in trouble. We all knew which banks were in trouble. So I actually wouldn't have been giving, first, I wouldn't have been giving money to banks that didn't need it. And to the banks that were going to get the money, if I had my own way, there I would have said, you can take this money, but we need to put some serious strings on how you're going to operate. Where do you come out on that?
I guess I think the issues with compensation reflect a much deeper ethical issue in our society, and particularly our business culture, which is that you would like people not to feel okay about taking money that they didn't earn, or about taking money in the face of a taxpayer bailout, or about CEOs like Angela Mozzillo of Countrywide and Stan O'Neill of Merrill Lynch walking away with hundreds of millions of dollars when their companies have been left totally, totally destroyed. And I don't actually know how you fix what is, to me, an ethical issue via any kind of legislation. And to steal Andrew's word earlier, it really is on Wall Street. It's a vicious circle, because when a Goldman Sachs says, but if we can't pay our people, they'll leave, they're telling the truth. That actually is what will happen, because there's somebody else who will pay them more. And what I don't understand is how pay has managed to become so disconnected from the value that the financial system actually provides. And so I think those are bigger issues. See, I'm becoming a populist. Look at that.
Question right here, please.
I'm wondering if regulation can be a double-edged sword. I was speaking with a banker this week, and they said because of the new regulation and how much money they have to keep on hand, they can't make the commercial loans that they'd like to be making. Do you think at all regulation is holding back the recovery of our economy to some extent?
Okay. I don't buy that argument. I've heard the argument, and philosophically it actually makes some sense, but I don't think we're at the point yet where it's actually the difference. To me, actually, the biggest difference right this moment around why banks are lending money or not is two things. So first of all, let's take one step back. The big banks are not loaning nearly as much money as the community banks are. And one of the reasons that is because they can still make an enormous amount of money from trading. They don't have to be making those loans to make the profits. The community banks, by the way, do. The second piece is the issue that I talked about earlier, which is the economy. And I think, as I said, a lot of these bankers still believe that it's raining or it's going to rain, and they're going to hold that money back. So I'm not sure that the capital requirements, by the way, to me are ultimately, and we talked about the legislation. The legislation is a sideshow to the one and only issue. When you think about this crisis or any other financial crisis we've really ever lived through, it has to do with leverage. It has to do with debt. And when you have too much debt in the system, this is what happens. And one of the only ways, I think, to really solve for that is this idea of higher capital requirements, of having a rainy day fund, of having more money in the kitty, if you will. And so I think that's actually crucial, but I don't think it's actually, at this point, holding us back. Having said that, I will make one, it's not a political point, but I'm sure it will be taken as a political point. You know, there are people in the business community right now that say that the administration and the government has exacerbated the economic problems in this country by changing the goalposts, that they don't really know where healthcare is going to end up, so they can't really actually make the capital investments they want to make. They don't really know where the Frank Dodd legislation will ultimately end up, so they can't make the right decisions. They look at the BP disaster and the moratorium, and they say, look, the government's willing to change the rules in the middle of the game. I think that may ultimately be impacting this, but it's only on the margins. But I don't think it's a non-argument, but I think we have much more fundamental problems that are actually putting us where we are today than the argument that somehow governments put us here. I think. I don't know.
Another question, please.
Yes, you spoke earlier of canaries in the coal mine, and I was curious, this is for Mr. Sorkin, if you think that perhaps disgraced former Governor Elliot Spitzer may have had a chance to be one of those canaries, and if so, how much did that contribute to his downfall?
Oh, goodness. This is a whatever answer, I'm losing on this answer no matter what. He was to some extent, and maybe if he had still been in office, certain things would have changed. But I don't know if it would have been on the margins. By the way, I get the question actually reversed, which is if Hank Greenberg, the CEO of AIG, had actually still been in his job, would have AIG had all these same problems? You could probably speak to this because you have a whole chapter about it. The problem with this answer is it really is that anything's possible. I will say one thing about canaries in the coal mine, which is there's a lot of people that since the crisis have come out, of course, and have said, I saw it coming, I knew it was here. Michael Lewis wrote a great book about five of them called The Big Short, five short sellers who did see it coming. In truth, though, I actually, A, don't think there were a lot of them, and B, all of us didn't want to hear it. We didn't want to listen. I actually think that's true. I've gone back, you know, people have blamed the media for not blowing the whistle loud enough. And by default, by the way, if that's our job, we didn't blow it loud enough. But, you know, you go back and there were stories of people talking about subprime loans and a housing bubble. And, you know, if you had read those stories in 2004 and decided I'm not going to buy a home for a year because I think it's going to go down, in 2005 you would have said, ugh, I feel like the train has already left the station. What am I going to do? And maybe I'll hold off for another year. And by 2006, you'd look around and you'd go, man, the train's really left the station. Maybe I got to get on. And this is what happens. And by the way, it's what's happening now. I think a lot of people, the market went down. All of a sudden, then it went up again. And now everybody's jumping back on the train because they're scared they're going to miss it again. And by the way, if you watch television or read the papers or read magazines or some of these great books that are out there, there are people that would be considered the canaries in the coal mine the next time. You know, Jamie Dimon, somewhat famously a couple of months ago, told this great story where he said his daughter called him up and said, you know, Daddy, what is a financial crisis? And his answer was, it's something that happens every 7 years. and it's sad, but somewhat true. If you think, by the way, that this financial crisis began in 2006, 2007, you can start dating when you think the next one's coming.
I'd follow up on Andrew's point with one additional point. I thought what you said is really interesting about, and I'd ask all of you in the audience that when you read something you don't agree with, or you read something that seems to be telling you something you don't want to hear, instead of lashing out at the author, just pause and think about it. Because I will tell you that as a journalist, if you write skeptical stories, the response is almost never, thank you. Thank you for warning me that my largest asset is about to decline in value. Geez, I feel so much better prepared now. The vitriol that comes at you as a member of the press when you write that a stock might decline, when you write that housing might be overvalued, is really astounding, and it's enough to actually discourage people from raising those sorts of questions. And I actually think that our audience could do a lot more just by hearing things in the spirit in which they're intended.
So, Mrs. Sorkin, I really enjoyed your book, and Ms. McLean, I certainly look forward to yours. Earlier on, you talked about perhaps some good guys and bad guys in this crisis. And one that I don't think you've touched on that I think is one of the major villains are the rating agencies. They seem to have skated this crisis with very little criticism and very little scrutiny. Do you have any ideas what can be done to hold these rating agencies to their proof?
It's a great question. Thank you for it. You also should answer this question because she actually goes into this in great detail in her book coming out next week, next Tuesday. she has a whole chapter on it or more. I think oftentimes about why we haven't spent more time talking about the rating agencies. And I've come to a very, maybe an odd conclusion, and maybe it's a very populist conclusion, which is that unlike the Wall Street story, where I can explain how people on one side lost their shirts and people on the other side are flying around in private planes. In the rating agency story, I don't think, and you can speak to this better than I can, I don't think anybody ever walked away with a fortune for this horrible mistake. They were conflicted, horribly conflicted, and I think that was part of it. But actually, having read part of your book now, on this particular subject, I'm not even sure. I actually look at this and think that this might have just been a horrible grand mistake. Meaning, you think it was actually deeper. You think it was truly nefarious.
There's a quote in our book that I love from a former rating agency analyst who, in the fall of 2007, after it was becoming clear that the rating agencies had slapped their coveted AAA rating on billions of dollars of worth of securities that didn't deserve it, a Moody's employee stands up in front of the rest of Moody's at a gathering and says, "You know, these errors, if you can call them that, make us look either incompetent or like we sold our soul to the devil for a little bit of revenue, or maybe both." And I think that's the tale of the rating agencies. It's a tale of incompetence, but it's also a tale of companies that were very much corrupted by the money that was available. And just because the money was small in Wall Street terms, and it was small in Wall Street terms.
But don't you think that's why we don't talk about it
today? I think we don't talk about it because it's so hard to figure out how to fix it. Right. And I think what the rating agencies do is somewhat complicated to most people. I think they've always been these immensely powerful forces in the market, immensely powerful. But they're kind of hidden parts of the machine. They're not the surface part of the machinery, so it's more difficult to grasp. And I think as we've witnessed through attempts at financial reform, somebody once said to me, the rating agencies have actually been a topic of conversation and controversy for a long time. There were hearings held about them in Congress in the wake of Enron's failure for their abysmal failure to catch Enron, which they rated investment grade, or safe enough for widows and orphans up until 4 days before its collapse. And nothing happened. Nothing changed. And I remember asking somebody about this in the years before the crisis, and they said, that's because nobody knows how the market would open Monday if you didn't have the rating agencies in place. And so it's this very thorny problem. I think the rating agencies and the government-sponsored housing enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, lurk out there as these issues that everybody knows are these enormous problems and nobody really knows how to fix. But just because the sums are small in comparison to Wall Street, there was every bit as much of greed going on in the rating agencies. I do. Mixed with incompetence.
There you got a better answer.
Mixed with incompetence. I don't know about that, but